The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Jessica Torres Cooper is titled "The Science of Joy." Imagine this. You're walking along a path in your favorite park when a butterfly suddenly flutters past. You stop to observe its magnificent colors, the curvature of its wings, and the velvety surface of its skin. To your surprise, it lands on your hand. You delight in mutually observing each other, and a profound feeling of well-being and satisfaction moves through you. What is that feeling? Is it joy? Is it happiness? Scientists are currently investigating the difference between the two. To understand the distinction and why it matters, we spoke with experts about what joy is and how we can cultivate it beyond the holiday season. While joy and happiness are both positive expressions, they are not one and the same. Happiness is a state of mind and well-being that can be modified by external events. Think of kids excitedly playing with their just-opened holiday gifts until a new distraction catches their attention. Joy, on the other hand, can be thought of as a feeling that is spontaneous and often involuntary, but richer and more meaningful than happiness. The intensity of the emotion we feel when we experience joy comes from an inner connection to what we value and a presence in the moment to appreciate it. It's the soul-settling awe, for example, of looking around a room and realizing how grateful you are for the people celebrating the holidays with you. Until relatively recently, experts rarely homed in on the nuances of this mysterious emotion. Joy is ineffable. It is not easy to talk about, says George E. Valiant, MD, a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. It can feel too intense, too private for others. The Victorians felt that way about sexual excitement. That is why social scientists and economists love happiness. Happiness is tame. Joy is laughing from the gut and weeping with joy. Happiness displaces pain. Joy encompasses pain. For the past few decades, psychologists, psychiatrists, and other researchers at leading universities have gathered and analyzed data to pinpoint exactly what defines joy. They don't always agree on a definition and often use terms like joy, bliss, and happiness interchangeably in their work. However, the American Psychological Association Dictionary of Psychology classifies joy into two distinct types: passive joy, encompassing tranquility and contentment, like being alone in nature, and the more expressive active joy, associated with engagement and the desire to share one's feelings with others. The latter feeling can often be intense, including pleasure, delight, and contentment to varying degrees. Where most scientists do align is on how joy benefits us. It's been found that joy not only contributes to good health and longevity, but like gratitude, can also bind us to one another. Our brains are hardwired with a motivational system that reinforces human connection, empathy, and attachment. And one of the keys to this system is joy. Ultimately, joy can lead us to make personal connections, strengthen our family bonds, and grow our community. For instance, babies are programmed to respond with an irresistible, joyous smile when making eye contact with their caregiver. Such social responses are evoked by, and in turn, produce mutual joy. Communal joy also has evolutionary value. If early humans did not band together, they may have perished. Explains Valiant, the limbic system, the part of our brain that's linked to behavior and emotion, helps facilitate strong attachment. Relationships, loyalty, and communal bonding were enormously helpful to our ancestors. He goes on to say that whereas happiness and excitement speed up the heart, joy and cuddling slow the heart down, reducing levels of cortisol, all of which produces a calm feeling. Joy is a connection to the universe, connecting us with others. It is about relationships. You can be happy by yourself, but it would be hard to feel joy on a desert island, says Valiant. One of the many ways joy in our brain chemistry brings people together is through laughter, which releases a feel-good cocktail of hormones. We release endorphins, giving us a feeling similar to a runner's high, says Jennifer Aker, PhD, a behavioral scientist and chaired professor at Stanford Graduate School of Business. We lower our cortisol, making us feel calmer. And these shifts in our brain impact not just how we see ourselves and how we behave, but how others see us and how they behave. Joy is not a happy accident, but a choice we make, Aker continues. It's about being more generous with your laughter and finding delightful moments in the day. When you don't take yourself too seriously, you laugh effortlessly, and that is when joy flows. In essence, humor paves the way for friendship and connection. It turns out that people who laugh together before having a conversation end up connecting in ways that feel 30% more intimate and authentic, says Aker. Not only are these connections crucial to forming strong community bonds, they can also have a lasting impact on our physical health. Loving relationships and a positive outlook protect us from mental and physical decline and are better predictors of longevity and a happy life than social class, IQ, or even genes, says the Harvard Study of Adult Development, which tracked participant health data for nearly 80 years. Other research indicates that joy can activate the parasympathetic nervous system, the part of our body that remains active when we're at rest, but that also leads to us feeling calm and relaxed. Activation of the parasympathetic system has been shown to buffer stress, lower pulse rate, promote digestion, and enhance memory. Joy, like any positive emotion, can contribute to living a good life, explains cognitive scientist Lori Santos, PhD, a professor of psychology at Yale University. Experiencing a more positive mood can improve things like your immune function. You may be thinking, if the secret to aging well is joy, then great, I'll spend all of my time doing what feels good. Easier said than done, since what truly brings joy may be more elusive than you'd expect. The reason is that humans can get used to gratifying experiences rather quickly. Think of the decline in pleasure one feels after the first bite of a brownie or after purchasing a big-ticket item. Once the novelty is worn off, we no longer draw the same bliss we once did. When we pursue happiness and think we've attained it, its meaning shifts, Aker says, and we return to our previous level of emotion and start the pursuit again. Psychologists call this phenomenon hedonic adaptation, or one's innate ability to return to a personal preset level of happiness no matter how life-changing an event has been. Luckily, there are still ways to cultivate ongoing moments of joy, and it starts with awareness. By recognizing that we have a natural tendency to balance out intense emotions, we can choose activities such as hobbies, journaling, and volunteering to help others that may alter our joy and happiness baseline. It turns out that joy is complex, but not impossible to find. Most important, once we do find it, joy is something we can unwrap throughout the year. Our companion article by Ada Rodriguez is titled Choosing Joy. When I was a kid growing up in Miami's inner city, we played a game called The Dozens, also known as roasting, cracking, or snapping. The aim was to poke fun at someone else in front of an audience. Nothing was off limits, not a dead relative, not illness, not even poverty. Whoever got the most laughs won. While most suburban kids were going to soccer practice after school, I was roasting my friends, walking home in the scorching heat. See, we didn't have the resources to deal with our pain and problems. We had to find joy in our circumstances, and I found it by making others laugh. Laughter became my currency, and I went on to establish a career in professional stand-up comedy. I have my childhood and the sport of roasting to thank for helping me develop a skill set for riffing, along with very thick skin. My friends often ask, "Yo, how do you always see the silver lining in messed up situations?" The answer is simple. Joy is always the better option. It's a choice you make, and sometimes choosing joy is the harder choice. For me, growing up poor and in the midst of violence, laughing at the tough stuff often allowed me to keep going. I'd have been a wreck if I were constantly down every time something bad happened. Something was always happening. Today I feel joy when I know others are laughing because of how I'm using my words, no different than those brutal summers on the block. I can close my eyes while on stage and see every single kid I grew up with cackling at the audacity of my mouth. Back then I knew people were laughing at the things I was saying, but I was unaware of what was happening on a subconscious level. I was healing through connection with others. I was choosing to see joy everywhere and didn't even know it, and that could only be good. These days when I'm not on stage, I spend time with my niece at the playground or volunteering at retirement homes. I feel deep joy for all the everyday people who make me laugh, but grandmas and babies are truly my jam. Human beings feel so perfect when they get here or are about to leave. It's somewhere in the middle where things get a little messy. Being able to brush off anything and move along in my own bliss is a gift. No matter how others may view where I came from, I will always be thankful to my hood for my quick wit and my unwavering superpower to call it all joy. Our next companion article by Gail King is titled Redefining Joy. Children have always brought me joy, which is part of the reason why I've always known I wanted my own. Fun fact, by the time I was in the 7th grade, I'd already picked out placeholder names for my future children, Rusty and Dusty. 20 years later, when I found out I was expecting my first child, I honestly really wanted a boy, mostly because as the eldest of 4 girls, I'd always dreamed of having a big brother. So when my favorite daughter Kirby arrived, I immediately thought, well, this isn't quite what I had planned. The point is, we tend to think that joy only comes in the form of momentous life events, like, say, having a child, and that all those big days add up to one joyous ball. But as I got older, I began to realize that it's not the bells and whistles that bring me joy. Instead, it's the little daily things, like when my daughter and son, yes, I did finally have a son, were kids, and I'd catch their last smile at bedtime and their first one in the morning. There was no other feeling like it. These days, the joys come in even smaller doses, like when I get a negative coronavirus test. I feel a sense of joy, not to mention deep relief. I even feel joy when the dentist calls to cancel my appointment. If you know me at all, you know that I'm terrified with a capital T of the dentist. Knowing that I have good health is 100% more important than ever. Another thing that fills me with joy, seeing someone else's dream come to life. Whether that's being accepted to the college of their first choice, or landing an ideal job, getting cast in a knockout movie role, or just receiving a really good birthday gift. Those moments never fail to lift me up. Bottom line, sure, I may be a lifelong member of Team Glass Half Full, but joy doesn't have to be something big and life-changing. In fact, I challenge you to take a page from my playbook and discover the little things that'll bring you joy each and every day. Here are some quotes about joy. Take the leap. If you're afraid to lean into good news, wonderful moments, and joy, if you find yourself waiting for the other shoe to drop, you are not alone. It's called foreboding joy, and most of us experience it. Joy is vulnerable. In our research, we found that everyone who showed a deep capacity for joy had one thing in common. They practiced gratitude. In the midst of joy, there's often a quiver, a shudder of vulnerability. Rather than using that as a warning sign to dress rehearse tragedy, the people who lean into joy use the quiver as a reminder to practice gratitude. Brené Brown, PhD, MSW. The unexpected thing that brings me joy is the full moon. After my mother died, she came to me as the moon in a dream and said, "Mija, don't worry, I'm watching over you." Ever since, every full moon that visits reminds me of this. Sandra Cisneros, author of Martita, I Remember You, Martita, Te Recuerdo. Spending time with little children, especially my own little nieces and nephews, always brings me joy. There's innocence and honesty in little children. I feel safe and loved, and they're safe and loved by me. Dolly Parton. Opening my curtains in the early morning and letting the light enter my room because it gives me a boost and helps me work hard for a better world. Malala, activist and Nobel Prize winner. Seeing, hearing, and being near the ocean, it balances me. I feel calm and grounded. It feels like home. Growing up in San Pedro, California, the ocean was one of the few constants in my life. Misty Copeland, principal dancer with American Ballet Theater. Our next article by Najin Farsad is titled Connection at the Dubuque Regional Airport. I spend a lot of time in airports. I have a sort of ritual about it. I have TSA pre-check, of course. I'm no newbie. I make sure everyone notices how airline appropriate my carry-on bag is. Only assassins travel this light. And I'm not one of those lumbering tourists wearing boots with buckles. Oh no. I can walk sideways while putting objects on a conveyor belt with the best of them. See, I'm a business traveler. Fast. But, to be clear, a comedian business traveler. The type that never gets to fly first class and carries a backpack, not an elegant crossbody laptop bag. I don't stay at luxury hotels, I wouldn't want points at the places I've stayed, and I don't have two cell phones. I'm still a business traveler, just more of a dirtbag business traveler. On my way to the gate, I begin the process of trying not to buy awful food. Why can't we have celery kiosks at airports? Where are the kale smoothie vending machines and bean sprout counters? I settle on a chocolate bar that seems to have organic free trade and/or French's packaging. I reason with myself that pure chocolate is better than one of those unnaturally fragrant pretzels. Do you know how hard it is for any human to walk by an aromatic pretzel shop and not buy one? Well, I do it. I walk by every time without buying one because I'm a business traveler. I then go to a Hudson News and stare at the magazine racks. I see lots of healthy, beautiful people on the covers and invariably walk away with my chocolate. I assure myself that I will never, ever buy chocolate again. I wonder how one chocolate once a week manages to keep me looking like a fat troll. I get angry with myself for calling myself a fat troll. Self-hate is a standard part of my airport ritual. I make my way to the gate and the introspection really sets in. The airport gives me too much time, too many opportunities for self-analysis. It makes me feel lonely and needy and judgmental all at the same time. I go to airports in small towns and sneer at the outdated fixtures. I look past the runways and see cornfields and think, how could anyone live here? And then I think, you're a mouthy big city snob. What makes you think it's not a great place to live? Oh, what, you don't see an Ethiopian restaurant every 10 blocks? You don't have to dodge dog urine puddles or, let's be honest, human urine puddles like you do in LA, so it's a horrible place to live? Thus goes the vicious cycle of judging and then feeling bad for judging. Wasted time, wasted petty thoughts circling in my head as if my head knew something. But there was one airport afternoon that made my ritual seem unerringly stupid. I was leaving Platteville, Wisconsin, population 11,000, en route to New York. I had just given a talk at the University of Wisconsin about diversity. My talk, punctuated with stand-up bits and PowerPoint jokes, could be summed up as, bigotry sucks. We have to try harder. Here are some ideas. But I say that for an hour and I use a bunch of hilarious graphs. A school administrator drove me, along with another speaker from that morning, to Dubuque Regional Airport in Iowa, the closest airport to ye olde Platteville. I sat in the front and chatted up the school admin, who knew an alarming amount about different cow types and the proportion of European versus Wisconsin cheeses. There was a pall over the ride because Rose, the guest in the back seat, was deaf. She couldn't communicate with us, couldn't share in the conversation, couldn't hear about the recent tornado that had swept away a few buildings on campus, or the reliability of the still American-made John Deere tractors. For a brief moment, I thought, oh no, I'm going to be stuck in a one-gate airport with this deaf woman? How will this work? Again, I kicked myself. You lazy punk, bigotry sucks, and you have to try harder. Please know, I have some great ideological positions. I've got rock-hard beliefs, not abs, just beliefs, that fit squarely into the realm of social justice, and I believe in them. I want to practice what I preach. I want to care and do and reform, but sometimes I find those beliefs exhausting. Is that how compassion is supposed to feel? Rose and I checked in and then sat together at a cafe. I didn't know how to communicate with her. I thought about the pieces of paper in my bag. Could I write her a note? It seemed strange for the two of us to sit silently looking at our phones and pretending that the other wasn't there. She broke the silence with a question on a notepad. Are you flying to Chicago? I wrote yes, then New York City. She replied that she was transferring in Chicago for Seattle. NYC, she wrote. I love NYC. A conversation was born over a notepad. We were both chatty people. Rose mentioned that she lived with her biological mother in Seattle. She had adoptive parents in Iowa, but they had passed away a few years ago, and she moved in with her biological parents. I was hooked. I had so many questions I couldn't jot them down fast enough. I still don't know the exact circumstances, but she was adopted at age 7. She showed me pictures on her phone of what seemed like a happy childhood, with one striking difference. She grew up a boy. I was sitting in the Dubuque Regional Airport with a transgender deaf woman who had been adopted. My airport routine was getting blown out of the water. I have been doing it wrong this whole time, wandering around eating chocolate and imagining the glamorous lives of other travelers demolishes your self-perception with an illusory world that fills you with envy. But speaking to other actual human beings, that's where you get the good stuff. Rose kept sending and receiving texts and taking pictures. I wondered who she was sending them to, but I didn't ask. Then, as if she could read my mind, she showed me a picture of her boyfriend. We took a selfie and she sent it on to her love. Her boyfriend, it turns out, was also transgender and also deaf. This was a community of people I had never really considered. It was a community of people that I think most people have never really considered. She showed me more pictures of him. She was bursting at the seams with pride, gushing with some kind of ethereal love shine, like a sunflower had sprayed sparkle bits all over her aura. She said on the notepad, "Transgender, 50 years old, and deaf. I didn't think love would happen for me. Damn it, Rose, now you're going to make me cry." She added, "He's 10 years younger than me." "That's right, Rose, you're a cougar. A cougar with a few hyphenated adjectives, but a cougar all the same." I can't even begin to fill in all the gaps in Rose's story. Her adoptive parents seem to have died at the same time. Her biological mother seems to have had a traumatic brain injury. Rose seemed to have multiple siblings. But what floored me was that she was recently diagnosed with MS, that hideous among awful diseases. Maybe she could tell that I was taken aback, so she reassured me. After the diagnosis, my boyfriend said he would always take care of me. Her giant sunflower full of love dust, her younger man. Of course he will love you. Of course he will take care of you. Life might deal you an inexorably difficult set of cards, but love is like absolute Kelvin. It freezes all the other stuff out. Matter becomes immaterial, and the only truth is that feeling. Those magazine stands, those rows of useless chocolates, the needlessly aromatic pretzels, and the internal self-hating dialogue, it has made me into an isolated silo, needing problems that aren't real problems. Talking to people around me, breaking the seal, showing compassion, that's what gets me out of my head and makes me actually feel better. Talking to a stranger seems exhausting at first, but every time I try it, I get a jolt of energy, a gift. On that day, the gift was Rose. Our next article by Gretchen Rubin is titled, 12 Things Gretchen Rubin Knows for Sure About Happiness. Gretchen Rubin is the best-selling author of several books, such as Outer Order, Inner Calm, and The Happiness Project, about how to be happier, healthier, and more productive. She also hosts the Happier with Gretchen Rubin podcast. For Oprah Daily, she weighs in on how we can all find a little bit of calm, even during a pandemic. In 2006, even though I was already relatively content, I was married to the tall, dark, and handsome love of my life. We had two delightful daughters. I was doing what I loved, writing, in the city that I loved, New York. I had close friends and family. I decided I wanted to be happier. I wasn't depressed, and I wasn't having a midlife crisis, but I was suffering from midlife malaise, a recurrent sense of discontent and almost a feeling of disbelief. So I set out on a year-long quest in which I test-drove cutting-edge science, the wisdom of the ages, and lessons from pop culture to try to be happier. I sang in the morning. I walked instead of taking the subway. I bought a laminator. I started a one-sentence journal. I picked up magazines I would have never read otherwise. I kept a food diary. I didn't postpone any task that could be done in less than 1 minute. Essentially, I used myself as a guinea pig to test every theory I could find. That resulted in, yes, more happiness, but also my best-selling book, The Happiness Project, which hit the shelf 12 years ago. In anticipation of that milestone, I started thinking about everything I've learned in the decade since then. I asked myself, what are some of the most important things I've learned about how we can make ourselves happier, healthier, more productive, and more creative? Here, I'll share 12 of the biggest lessons. You need to be specific about your intentions. Happiness can seem like an abstract, transcendent concept with many elements tangled up in each other. So to help clarify my thinking, I realized that it's helpful to consider how I might get more feeling good by adding more love, more fun, more enthusiasm, more engagement to my life. Get less feeling bad by eliminating sources of irritation, anger, resentment, boredom, or guilt. Examine whether I feel right about the shape of my life and how I'm putting my values out into the world. Find an area where I can create an atmosphere of growth in which I'm learning, teaching, improving, or helping. It's essential that we know ourselves, but we don't know ourselves as well as we think. To create a happy life, we need to know ourselves, think who you are and what you value, your likes and dislikes, your hopes and values, and embrace our own natures. Now, you might think, well, how hard could it be to know myself? I'm with myself all day, every day. But chances are you probably don't understand yourself as well as you think you do. That's because it's so easy to get distracted by what we wish were true or what we assume is true. The only way to build a happy life, though, is on the foundation of our own interests, our own values, our own temperament, and our own circumstances. There is no best or right way to build a happy life. There's only what works for each and every one of us. Some people need accountability, while other people don't like to have someone looking over their shoulder. Some people, myself included, are at their most energetic early in the morning, while others are at their best late in the day. Some people love simplicity, while others love abundance. Some like to work slow and steadily, while others prefer to sprint hard toward a finish line. Once we know ourselves, we can shape our lives to suit what's true for us. One of the best ways to make yourself happy is to make other people happy. One of the best ways to make other people happy is to be happy yourself. People often focus on the first half of this statement, which, to be fair, is absolutely true and one of the nicest things about human nature. But the second half is equally important. Research shows happier people are more interested in the problems of others and the problems of the world. In addition to being more forgiving and more tolerant of frustration, happier people volunteer more time, donate more money, are more likely to vote, and are more likely to help others. In fact, in a study conducted by Harvard Business School and the University of British Columbia, researchers asked participants to recall the last time they spent $20 or $100 on themselves, or the last time they spent $20 or $100 on someone else, then gave them small amounts of money which they could either spend on themselves or someone else. Not only did people feel happier when they were asked to remember a time they bought something for someone else, but the happier they felt about their past generosity, the more likely they were to have spent that small amount of money on someone else. That's in part because when we care for ourselves, we strengthen ourselves to care for others. And it's why that airplane instruction to put on your own oxygen mask first has become such a cliche. It's a cliche because it's true. Happiness is contagious, so surround yourself with people who will pass on positivity. Researchers and scientists have spent a lot of time studying what does and doesn't make us happy, and nearly all agree on one thing. Social interaction is the most reliable way to increase people's positive emotions. To be happy, we need enduring, intimate bonds. We need to be able to confide. We need to feel like we belong. We need to be able to get, and just as important for happiness, give support. In fact, one Harvard study, which followed the same group of men for more than 80 years, found that having strong personal connections with other people was most directly correlated to overall happiness, better health, and more contentment. And that's especially true if you surround yourself with happy people. Researchers behind a longitudinal analysis published in the BMJ found that a person is 15% more likely to be happy if a friend is happy, and that a person's happiness can also influence and be influenced by their friends' friends and even friends' friends' friends. The bottom line, anything we do to deepen or broaden our relationships tends to be a happiness booster. Good habits set you up for a good mood. Habits are the invisible architecture of daily life. Research shows that we repeat about 40% of our behavior almost daily. So if we have habits that work well for us, we're much more likely to have a happy life than if we don't have those habits. That leads to the question, how do we most effectively change our habits? That answer led me to another realization. There are four categories of people: upholders, questioners, obligers, and rebels. As I was researching habits, I was very puzzled by patterns and how easily people did or didn't form habits. Why did some people keep asking, why can I keep my promises to other people, but I can't keep my promises to myself? Why did some people object to the arbitrariness of making a New Year's resolution on January 1st? At last, I hit on my four tendencies personality framework, which distinguishes how people respond to expectations, including both outer expectations, a work deadline, a request from a friend, and inner expectations, start meditating, keep a New Year's resolution. Upholders respond readily to outer and inner expectations. By the way, I'm an upholder, 100%. Think discipline is my freedom. Questioners, as the name suggests, question all expectations. They'll meet an expectation if they think it makes sense, meaning they make all expectations into inner expectations. Think, if you convince me why, I'll comply. Obligers, which is the biggest tendency for both men and women, meet outer expectations but struggle to meet expectations they impose on themselves. So to meet an inner expectation, they need outer accountability. Think, you can count on me and I'm counting on you to count on me. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They can do anything they choose to do, but if you ask or tell them to do something, they're likely to resist. Think, you can't make me and neither can I. Once you know your tendency, you can figure out how to change your habits in the way that best suits you. For example, upholders thrive when things are scheduled and tracked. Obligers, on the other hand, rely on oversight, deadlines, and consequences, as well as the occasional treat. Novelty and challenge boost happiness. When I was writing the Happiness Project, I kept coming across study after study showing novelty and challenge make people happier. According to the research, the brain is stimulated by surprise, and successfully dealing with an unexpected situation leads to a powerful sense of satisfaction. So if you do new things, learn a new hobby, visit a new place, meet new people, try a new restaurant, you're more apt to feel happy than people who stick to more familiar activities. To be honest, this came as a big surprise to me. In fact, I remember thinking, well, that might be true for most people, but I love familiarity and mastery. So I decided to test this with a self-experiment. I would start a blog, an aim that at that time seemed very novel and challenging. Remember, this was 2006. And I realized that even for someone like me, novelty and challenge did make me happier. Since then, I've done many novel, challenging things, such as starting the Happier with Gretchen Rubin podcast, doing a live tour for the podcast, and launching the Happier app. Each time, these undertakings give me many moments of anxiety and frustration, but after I push through those feelings, I do feel happier. Small changes can make a surprisingly big difference. Sometimes as simple as Happiness Project resolutions have done the most to boost our happiness. On the Happier podcast, I suggested that listeners walk 20 in 20. Walk for 20 minutes each day in 2020. In 2021, I suggested that listeners read 21 in 21. Read for 21 minutes every day in 2021. Over and over, I've heard from people who said that making these small, manageable daily changes transformed their lives. Your body matters. It may sound obvious, but it's easy to overlook. And the truth is that our physical experience always colors our emotional experience. So to make sure I'm taking care of me, I remind myself to treat myself like a toddler. If you've ever raised a toddler, or been around one for that matter, you know it involves a lot of planning. Do you have a snack in case they get hungry? Will you be able to do that and get them down for their nap? Did you pack a toy that they can play with? Because when you don't, the consequences can be very unpleasant. In the same way, to be good-humored and well-behaved, I need to make sure I have my coffee, my cell phone charger, my constant snacks, and my 8 hours of sleep. Additionally, I make sure to move my body. I'm a natural couch potato, so I find it really helpful to pair exercise with something I enjoy, like listening to my favorite podcast only when I'm on the treadmill, and spend time outdoors. For most people, outer order contributes to inner calm. For most people, making an effort to keep surroundings in reasonable order really pays off in happiness. Yes, a messy desk or a crowded coat closet may seem like a trivial problem, yet getting control of the stuff of life often makes it easier to feel more in control of our lives generally. In fact, whenever I ask people, what changes have made you happier? People often respond, now I make my bed every day. It's not the most significant change you can make, but it is effective. Now is always the best time to begin. It's easy to think, I'll start next month, after the holidays, after things settle down, but the perfect day never arrives. As the old sayings go, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Don't get it perfect, get it going. The longest journey starts with a single step. The days are long, but the years are short. Of everything I've ever written, I think it's this one short sentence that has resonated most with people. I remind myself of this truth every day. Our next article by Michelle Darasaw is titled, Here's How to Make New Friends as an Adult. Things were so much easier when we were kids, including making friends. Back when saving for retirement and anti-aging creams were in the very distant future, maybe you didn't give much thought to chatting up your peers at the playground. But now that socializing is probably at the bottom of your long list of priorities, you might be wondering how you'd even make friends as an adult in the first place, or why you should bother. Beyond having a close-knit group of people to vent about your problems with, or to accompany you on your next girls' trip, maintaining human interpersonal relationships can significantly impact your physical and mental health. According to a 2010 report in the Journal of Health and Social Behavior, having strong social ties can boost your immune system and help you to live a longer, more fulfilling life. Not only that, researchers found that cultivating friendships can decrease the risk of heart disease and high blood pressure, as well as reduce the impact of stress and chronic pain. With those benefits in mind, the most important thing to remember is that when it comes to your overall well-being, it's never too late to let go of toxic relationships and meet new people. Whether you're a recent transplant to a new town or you're interested in adding a few fresh faces to your inner circle, there are some practical things you can do to make and keep friends as an adult. First step, put yourself out there. Download the friend-finding app, Hey Vena. If you just moved to a new city, Hey Vena is the perfect app to use to find friends nearby. Think of it as Tinder for female friends, where you view someone's profile to determine whether you need to swipe left to pass on connecting, or swipe right to send a virtual hello to a potential match. Olivia June launched the app in 2015 after relocating to San Francisco to pursue a career in tech. I joined OkCupid because it was popular at the time, she tells us. Even though it was good at matching me with compatible people, the chemistry wasn't factored in. It would show me profiles of women who were similar to me, but it was awkward to reach out to other girls for friendship because the intentionality of the platform was for dating. So Olivia June built Hey Vena as an empowering community for women. And for East Coast transplants like me, it's taken the anxiety out of meeting and talking to new people. In my personal experience, having a user-friendly and dynamic app with fun quizzes and the ability to chat with other women has led to a fun coffee date with a fellow Southerner, karaoke night with a Brooklyn-based newbie, and of course, some fascinating book recommendations. Join a meetup group. Playdates don't have to be reserved for children, thanks to Meetup. Launched in June 2002, the service was created for people to connect with like-minded individuals in different online groups and to host in-person events for users with similar interests. Meetup is accessible on a personal computer, tablet, or through its phone-based app. If you enjoy reading books, knitting, watching movies, traveling, or indulging in spa treatments in your spare time, there are specific groups tailored to your hobbies, ethnicity, and even your job or college major. In addition, if you're the outgoing type or your passion isn't currently represented on the platform, feel free to start your own group for members to join. Take adult classes. Remember those days when you could strike up a new friendship just by trading notes or sitting next to someone in class? Tap into that whim as an adult by participating in adult classes or workshops that center around something you've always wanted to learn how to do. Need to brush up on your skills in the kitchen? Take a cooking or baking class and spark a conversation with the person at your workstation. From crafting and dancing to writing and cycling, you can search for available classes that are available near you online or check out community colleges or local institutions offering self-improvement or recreational courses. Find a local book club or visit the library. If, in fact, you can read your way to happiness, you might as well do it with someone by your side. According to the New Yorker, which reported on a 2011 study featured in the Annual Review of Psychology, people who read most fiction are better at empathizing with others. So instead of snuggling up at home with one of the buzziest books, take a trip to the library and see if there's anyone in your favorite section who piques your interest or who's eyeing an anticipated read you can't wait to bury your nose in. Better yet, form a book club with your neighbors or your new friends from Hey Vina or Meetup. Take your dog for a walk at a nearby park. The next time you take your furry companion out for a walk, make the rounds at a dog park. This takes the pressure off meeting complete strangers since you already have something in common, a love for four-legged animals. Observe which pet your dog takes a liking to and start a conversation with their owners. Although it may not lead to you finding your future BFF, you'll be able to trade funny stories and frustrations about your pup's habits. And at the very least, you'll have someone to look forward to talking to while your dog is also making friends. Use social media to your advantage. Social media can be helpful when seeking out new or old friends, as well as networking for business opportunities. Though limiting your interaction with strangers to 140 characters or a double tap may seem intimidating at first, just know that you could be one comment or like away from a budding friendship. If you're following someone who posts great photos or shares funny tweets, reply and engage with that person by asking questions. After all, who doesn't like reading positive compliments? Tweets and responses may eventually lead to direct messages, which in turn could lead to future outings in person. Another tip is to start searching hashtags around your interests and location. If adult coloring, makeup, cooking, or binge-watching Netflix is your thing, you can find others by typing in those keywords preceded by the number sign. Likewise, when you post your own thoughts and photos on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, make sure you use a hashtag so others can find you. Our next article by Stephanie Farrington is titled, Why This Former Gucci-Clad Executive Pivoted from a Big Media Job to Cleaning Up After Donkeys. With his knee deep in the dirt and surrounded by dung, Ron King starts his day at the crack of dawn. There's a long list of tasks he must complete before the day ends at Oscar's Place, the animal sanctuary he co-founded in response to the enduring plight of donkeys. Their worldwide population is projected to be cut in half by 2024 as their hides continue to be used for a medicinal Chinese herb called Iaho to treat anemia, insomnia, and blood circulation problems. Surrounded by four-legged creatures on a sprawling 75-acre property in Mendocino County, California, he is as far from the glitz and glamour of his past life as he could get, and he's never been happier. For two decades, the former Time Inc. media executive's life seemed impossibly good. He'd met and partnered with the man of his dreams, adopted an 11-year-old boy named Shane, and continued ascending the corporate ladder, which afforded him a lifestyle he never dreamed of. World travel, fine dining, and a closet full of Gucci, Versace, and Armani. But his staggering success belied the hardship and pain he endured in his formative years. Born and raised in Arkansas to Christian missionaries, King never felt that he fit in. I grew up as the gay son of a Southern Baptist preacher in rural America in the 1970s. The message I received from an early age was that I wasn't good enough and nobody would have my back. At 17, he moved away for college, but having absorbed the belief that he was unworthy and incapable, he stumbled through the next decade of his life. For years, I was in a really bad place. I was a drug addict. I was homeless when I was 26. I even turned tricks for shelter, he says. While waiting tables at the Hard Rock Cafe in 1995 in LA, an angel in the guise of a crotchety old waitress named Mary Ann pulled him aside and said, "When you're ready to clean up your life, I will help you." At first, he rejected her overtures. I was like, mind your own business, old lady, because I was a snot-nosed young drug addict. Then the worst happened. King attempted to take his own life in 1996. He finally accepted help from the nosy waitress who regularly checked in on him. She took me to my first AA meeting, he recalls. Afterwards, she drove me to my dealer's house, where I was sleeping on the floor. She came in and nobody was home. She poured out all of his liquor and left her tip money on his table for him to buy some more the next day. She said, "I will be back tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. to take you to your next meeting," and I have never had another drink or drug. Over the next year, King cleaned up and stabilized his life. While waiting tables one day, a customer who ran a company that distributed and sold VHS how-to fishing videos spotted his charisma and easy way with customers and offered him a job in sales. "He taught me almost everything I know about business," he says. "From there, I was off and running." By 2002, King began to scale unimaginable heights, from landing a Don Draper-esque role as an account supervisor at advertising agency Gray Global, to nabbing the top publisher spot at Southern Living, where he resuscitated the brand, to becoming the visionary senior vice president of 7 prominent glossies: InStyle, People Style Watch, People in Espanol, Essence, Southern Living, Coastal Living, and Sunset. Once I started moving in directions that were positive for my life instead of negative, it just started compounding, he says. But his tendency toward workaholism put too much strain on his relationship. And then his career as he knew it unraveled when Meredith Corporation, a Midwest magazine publisher, purchased the iconic Time Inc. in early 2018. "I had really run myself into the ground and I had lost my relationship," says King. "I found myself with plenty of money and plenty of designer clothes, but alone and unhappy. Looking to reset and recalibrate, I took a package and left," he says. Though King yearned for time off, he was open to new opportunities. A successful friend named Phil Selway hired him to manage his real estate portfolio and sell a sprawling 75-acre estate in Mendocino County. While preparing the property to be listed, King moved onto the property, a ranch at the edge of Redwood Forest in Northern California. He watched vapid TikTok videos and worked up shallow sweats on his SoulCycle bike. But a few weeks in, he felt a sweet emotion radiate through his whole being. "I was going on a hike and I had this very unfamiliar feeling, like, what is it that I'm feeling right now?" he asked himself. "And I realized it was serenity and I was calm." Settling into a less frenetic frame of mind and life, King was scrolling through TikTok when he came across a video of an anguished woman pleading for someone to rescue maltreated donkeys at a kill pen auction in Texas. Moved and upset, King Googled more about the plight of donkeys and read an especially alarming headline in the UK newspaper The Guardian: "World's donkeys being decimated by demand for Chinese medicine." The more he learned, the more he wondered if maybe he could transform his friend's land into a donkey refuge. "Could I do this? Do I want to do this?" King asked himself. "Why am I having all these feelings?" While trying to determine if he could tackle the challenge of running a donkey farm, he came to a new self-discovery. "I enjoy Gucci suits and my Mercedes AMG and eating at the great restaurants and valet parking at the movie theater," he muses. "But they didn't bring me any joy. What brings me joy is either connection or impact," he says. "Connection to someone or something, or having an impact on my world in some way." Without ever having set eyes on a donkey in real life, he knew with cosmic certainty how he should use Selway's farm. When he presented the idea to his employer, it didn't go down easy. "He 1,000% thought that I had gone mad. He was caught completely off guard." But King, a persuasive salesman who still tapped into the basic set of skills he had learned from hawking fisherman videos, convinced Selway, an animal advocate who had always wanted his own legacy to be centered on animal welfare, over a set of omelets and some coffee at Bluebird Cafe in Hopland, California, near the property. "He humored me in the beginning," says King. "Then I went to work." Oscar's Place, a nonprofit named after Selway's cat who passed away, seeks to rehabilitate and rehome abandoned or abused donkeys. In a short span of time, the organization has saved 78 donkeys, laid to rest 3, and delivered 6 healthy foals. "When the first 5 donkeys arrived in December 2020, he says, "I fell madly in love with them." King goes into raptures over their standout qualities and achievements, how they've helped build civilization since the beginning of time, how they're incredibly intelligent, and how the part of their brains that processes emotion is the same size as ours. "They're very emotional creatures," he says. "I go out in the morning and call them and they come running to me. They're dog-like. The babies are especially scrumptious. They love to hug. If you sit down, the babies will jump up in your lap." None, however, have captured his heart like Viejo. "He'll put his head on my shoulder and I'm standing there petting him, and you can tell we're both exhaling because it's calming. Here I am with this 1,100-pound animal who loves me and I love him, and we're here to help each other and enjoy this life, he says. King recently shared a picture of Viejo on Instagram beside a caption that reads, "One of the strongest connections that I have felt in my life is with this guy right here. I can't believe the love I feel for these guys." Youthful and handsome at 52, King breaks down the arduous nature of his new life. "It is physically exhausting. I'm throwing bales of hay and carrying 50-pound bags of concrete and chasing after animals who kick and bite when you're trying to give them injections," he says. After pausing to consider it all, he adds, "It's just a completely different and very hard life, and I've never been happier." Earlier this year, in the middle of the pandemic, King shared his life story in a podcast titled "Wrong King, That Shit," a phrase he developed during his Time Inc. days to express the act of applying sheer determination to bounce back from the many impossible situations he faced. In the podcast, King speaks candidly about the difficult moments in his life and reveals traumatic circumstances that even members of his family were unaware of. "I thought I should make the point that I don't have it all figured out," he says through tears on the podcast. "I'm only sharing my journey in case it's helpful. I had hoped that a drug addiction and being homeless and cancer and a broken neck was enough, that I had paid my dues, but it never stops coming at you. I am determined to live a life that's worthwhile and meaningful." As for his donkeys, over the next year, King plans to rehabilitate and rehome 100 donkeys, introduce programming to help educate the public, create videos to help amplify the organization's mission, and collaborate with local schools by offering internships and academic credit. Oscar's place, this property, these animals, and this mission will live long beyond me, he says, marveling at the wonder of it all. "When I look back on this journey, one of the things I will be most proud of is providing a second chance to these deserving animals. I know that I have changed the course of their lives, and their impact on me has been immeasurable." Our next article by Eleni N. Gage is titled, "How to Cultivate a Shift in Your Own Perspective." A breath of fresh air. Shaking a deep belief can be tough, even when we're positive that it isn't serving us well. To actively change your point of view, Lori Santos, professor of psychology at Yale University and host of the Happiness Lab podcast, suggests these three steps. First, stop and take stock. Psychologists refer to the hot-cold empathy gap, Santos says. If you're in a hot state, you're really emotional, hungry or pissed off or scared. It can be really hard to do a mindset shift. Inhale and exhale. In order to regain a cooler mood, take a deep breath, says Santos. It activates your vagus nerve, which turns off your fight-or-flight system. And ask the right questions. When you have the emotional wherewithal to think through your situation, follow a series of queries author Byron Katie developed called The Work. Is this really true? Can I absolutely know for certain with no doubt at all that this is true? How do I react when I believe this thing? And who would I be without believing that thought? Let's say the perspective you want to change is, "I hate my body, it's terrible," says Santos. You insist, "Yes." But the second question forces you to acknowledge that there is a world in which you can think of this differently, says Santos. You may stop and be like, "Well, I guess it's not all terrible. My heart works pretty well." Then you may realize, if I believe my body sucks, I don't treat it well. If I didn't believe that thought, I might treat my body better. In short, says Santos, the work is a process of interrogating our expectations. Often we find out that they are outdated or wrong, or there are expectations for Instagram models, but not for me, a 40-something podcaster and busy professor. Once you realize your perspective isn't serving you anymore, it's much easier to take another breath and let it go. What just happened? When the world shifts beneath you and your mindset needs to catch up, follow the advice of these experts, from philosophers to psychologists. No change is inevitable. A professor of philosophy at Yale and author of the book Transformative Experiences, L.A. Paul warns, as you undergo these shifts, they rearrange you mentally. The things you care about change in ways you can't predict. Uncertainty is just part of living. We should embrace it. Don't just react. reflect. The main thing that I've learned from decades of exploration of Buddhist meditation and psychotherapy is that we can't really change what's happening to us or even what we're feeling. But we have some control over how we relate to our experience, says psychiatrist Mark Epstein, author of The Zen of Therapy. To see your reactions rather than being taken over by them, freeing you from the exclusive identification with whatever you see to be wrong with you, that's the main move, whether you do it through meditation, psychotherapy, or religious practice. The capacity to be self-reflective is inherent in humans. We can all do it. Say your name. In his book Chatter, The Voice in Our Head, Why It Matters and How to Harness It, psychologist Ethan Cross offers a quick fix to help you see complicated situations in a new light. In neuroscientific studies in his lab, when researchers monitored subjects' brain activity while showing them disturbing photographs, they found that the participants who asked themselves, "What is Jennifer feeling?" rather than "What am I feeling?" showed much less emotional activity in their brain, and that it took a single second for their emotional activity to downshift. The linguistic shift of talking to yourself in the third person disarms your defenses, putting you into a slightly more objective mode, he explains. This tool, which we call distant self-talk, helps people to step back and take broader stock of the situation, which is where the solutions often lie. Practice gratitude. Maya Shankar, the host of the podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, explains cognitive science teaches us that we can fall prey to what's called the focusing illusion, where we overweight the relative value of the thing we're currently focused on. To counteract that, when she and her husband lost identical twin girls to a miscarriage with their beloved surrogate, they made a gratitude list. "Even though I was hurting and it was the last thing I wanted to do," she says. The idea is not to devalue any given thing you care about, but to remember that there is a vast array of things that bring you happiness. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.